We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish in this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday.
This past week, a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court upheld a temporary stay against President Trump's executive orders on immigration. This, of course, has caused a great deal of consternation, and depending on which legal school of thought you belong to, was either good or bad, but has also caused a lot of confusion. And many people, my wife included, have asked me questions about what's going on here, what's really happening. So I thought we'd take a look at the fight over executive orders and what many people are calling judicial review. This is Constitution Thursday, where we sit down and we talk about what the Constitution says, what it means, what it meant when it was written, how it's been interpreted, and how it affects your life even today. Eloqui conitio, stand up, tell those who oppose liberty, don't tread on me. If you go back to 2012, it was a June day, as I recall. We were all eagerly anticipating the Supreme Court's ruling on the Obamacare, or Affordable Care Act. By the way, I was told this week that as many as a third of Americans don't know that those two things are the same thing. I have no idea how that's possible, but apparently it is. We were waiting for that ruling, and when it came out, there was a lot of hubbub, and if you remember watching television that morning, I was watching it along with much of the country. And initially, the reports were that it had been struck down, but they hadn't read far enough. They were reading the opinion as quickly as they possibly could. And what had been rejected by the court was an argument, not the actual law. And by the time we were done 15 or 20 minutes later, people had realized that on a 5-4 vote with Justice Roberts upholding that, the Supreme Court had ruled the Obamacare mandate to be constitutional on the basis that it was a tax, not a fine. Now, this was important, and of course, it caused a lot of consternation, it caused a lot of arguments, caused a lot of people to question some things about Justice Roberts and so forth and so on, and that's fine. Buried deeply within his opinion that he issued that day was a citation. Now, a citation is where the Supreme Court references another case, which may or may not have set precedent, but it influenced their decision. And that's what I want to get to today. We're going to talk about the concept of judicial review, which is the idea that the court can review a law. This is an important concept because it's one that's been around for a very long time. In fact, the arguments over judicial review are as old as the Constitution itself. In fact, we can go back to the ratification debates in the Federalist Papers. Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Number 78 deals extensively with the power of the courts. We've talked about this on numerous occasions. He talks about the fact that the judiciary is the weakest of the three branches of government because it has neither the power of the purse, it has no force, it has no military like the presidency does. All it literally has is judgment. And it would depend upon the political branches the executive and legislative, to then uphold its judgments. And so there was little to fear, Hamilton wrote, from the judiciary, which is interesting. Of course, if you think about this, the Hamiltonian model of the Constitution, interpretation of the Constitution, is, again, if it doesn't say we can't, we can. As opposed to the Jeffersonian model, which says if it doesn't say we can, we can't. Madison was very adamant about these things, and Madison would go on to be very active as a member of the United States government in its early days. He also discusses in Federalist 78 this concept of judicial review. Now, depending on which side of the equation you're on today politically, you may or may not understand judicial review, but you may or may not support judicial review. I would suggest to you that if you are conservative, or politically passes for conservatism today, you probably would oppose the idea of judicial review. If you are liberal, which is a term I don't like, but progressive on the political scale, you're probably in favor of judicial review. This is not saying it's right or wrong. It's simply saying, or right or left, as the case may be, it's simply saying that there are two different ways of looking at the issue. And the Constitution itself is silent upon the matter. It does not say judicial review yes, judicial review no. Now again, if you're a Hamiltonian, if it doesn't say you can't, you can. If you're a Jeffersonian, if it doesn't say you can, you can't. So depending on who you're talking to at any particular moment will really decide whether or not you favor the idea of judicial review. Now, judicial review is simply the process by which a judge can review a law passed by the legislative branch, signed by the executive. The judge then looks at the law and determines whether or not the law is in what we would call constitutional. Is it in line with the Constitution? That's all it is. That's all it means. Now, you may be shaking your head going, well, Dave, if that's all it is, well, of course I'm for that, because that's what the judicial does, right? Not always. It didn't start out that way. When it initially started, the idea of judicial review was almost an anathema to the members of the court and the government in general. Didn't take long. I mean, we're going to get to that in just a moment. Hamilton in 78, Federalist 78, writes in favor of judicial review, as he naturally would. He argues that the federal courts have the duty to determine whether the acts of Congress are constitutional and whether they follow the Constitution and make us follow the Constitution when there's its consistency. Hamilton's position was that this was a protection against the abuse of power by Congress. And you certainly would have to think that it could be. I mean, we think about the Sedition Act of 98. We think about other cases that have come along that Congress didn't always do the right thing. They passed laws that seemingly were in violation of basic protections in the Constitution. And yet, sometimes the courts overturned them, and sometimes they did not. This idea of judicial review was still very fluid in the early days of the Republic. And that's where I want to take us. As we look at what's going on right now with the Ninth Circuit Court, with the President, Donald Trump, and his executive orders. And again, you know, I have a show Mondays and Wednesdays where I can talk about the politics of the whole thing, the rightness and the wrongness of the whole thing. You can turn on your radio, go online, read a website, and you'll get arguments and debates and name-calling from right and left as to the rightness, the wrongness, the morality of this whole situation. What I want you to do at the end of this 30 minutes is to be able to say, oh, this is why this argument is happening. Not whether this argument, you have to decide for yourself which side of the argument you're on. I think that there are cogent arguments on both sides. There really are, which is why we have a court to hear those arguments and decide it. Now, whether or not the Ninth Circuit Court heard those arguments completely different animal. Maybe we can get into that on Monday or even Wednesday, but the basic underlying premise of the argument is this idea of judicial review. If you've read the Ninth Circuit ruling, and it's not long, it's not complicated, page after page of this is dedicated to the idea that we can review this. That was the government's position, was that Trump's order, President Trump's order, was unreviewable. The government, in my view, did a very poor job of explaining why that was the case. Be that as it may, the court, the Ninth Circuit Court, addressed the question they addressed was not whether or not the order was unconstitutional or not, but whether or not they had the authority, the place, the duty, as Hamilton would have put it, to review it. And they decided that the courts did have that authority. And in essence, that's what the ruling says. No, we can review this. There was some more elements to it as to, you know, what exactly are we supposed to review here? But that's a story for another day. In 1794, let's go back to 1794. Now, usually when you talk about judicial review, people who are at all familiar with the concept will jump immediately to 1803 and go to Marbury versus Madison. But really, the idea of judicial review, as far as the Supreme Court was concerned, and in general the courts were concerned, began in 1794. Alexander Hamilton in 1794 was the Bueller. Anybody remember what job he had in the federal government in 1794? That's right. He was the Secretary of the Treasury and had been basically for the entire Washington administration. They had about a year left by 1794, but he had been a part of that administration all along. Now, this was right after the second, by 1792 was the second presidential election. So we've had that. We're in the run-ups to the midterms of 1794. And while Washington has won re-election to the presidency unanimously in the Electoral College, although it's one of those little weird things in history, it doesn't look like he was unopposed, because the rules of those days required the electoral voters to actually list two candidates. But he was technically unopposed. And so he won unanimously in the Electoral College. But an interesting thing had happened around 1792 and into the 1794 elections, and that was really the development and really the splitting apart of the two-party system, where there was no longer this consuming idea of political unity in the country anymore. There were people who were really starting to oppose the president's policies and the policies of what was perceived as his party, which would have been essentially the ideals of Hamilton. Remember that Washington really liked Hamilton. Hamilton pushed Washington into the first national bank of the United States, those kinds of things, central banks. And Washington was not against those things. They weren't addressed in the Constitution, but Washington's interpretation of the Constitution was very much in line with Hamilton's, which was very simply, if it doesn't say we can't, then we can. This was Hamiltonian in and of itself. By 1794, by the summer of 1794, Hamilton had managed to push through Congress a bill that was a tax. Now, taxes are touchy subjects to Americans, far more in that era than they ever were today. Today we hear about another tax, and what do? We complain about it. We know those stupid politicians that don't know what they're doing. They're just raising our taxes again and spending willy-nilly. But in 1794, the people you were taxing were people that had fought for this country, who had founded this country, and what was essentially a tax revolt. They were not happy about this idea of taxes. And in fact, the Constitution, if you will recall, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, and Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3, really limits the power of taxation for the United States to what were called direct taxes. They had to be apportioned by the state's populations. They couldn't just be willy-nilly levied on the people. Hamilton came up with this tax that he wanted to run because the government needed money and they needed to take care of those things. There were things that needed to be taken care of, and so Hamilton was in charge of raising money. He came up with an idea, presented it to Congress, they approved it, the president signed it, and on June 5th of 1794, the carriage tax went into effect in the United States. Now, I don't want to bore you with all the legislation. I have it in front of me, but it's, you know, it's in the legal language of the day. But in essence, what it said was, if you have a carriage or a chariot or a cart or something that's used to transfer people, not goods, but people, you are going to be taxed $10 per year on that carriage. So there you go. And if you, in modern day terms, this would be saying, do you have a car? We're going to levy an annual tax on your car. Now, today we look at that and go, well, we call it a vehicle licensing fee here in California, and a license, you know, we have all these names for it, but it's essentially the same thing. It's a carriage tax that Hamilton first started pulling in 1794. The idea here was they could raise some revenue, maybe build some roads, do some things, pay for the government. And he wanted everybody to pay this in September. Well, there was a man by the name of Hilton who, for some reason, and I'm not clear why, there's not a whole lot on him in history, owned somewhere around 100 carriages. He did not have a carriage business. He did not have like a taxi cab business or a stagecoach line or anything like that. He just happened to own 100 carriages. And he didn't want to come up with $1,000 to pay this tax. Is that the right number? 10 times 100? Yeah. He didn't want to do this. And so he objected to this, and he took it to the courts, and he said, look, this is unconstitutional because it's not being apportioned. It's a direct tax being unapportioned by the Congress. And it says right here that taxes have to be apportioned. And just because I have a lot of carriages, I call it a carriage, but it's because I'm thinking cars. This is unfair, and I don't think it's right. I think it's unconstitutional. And for the first time, this is 1794 now, and by the time the thing goes to the case, it's 1796. By the time he goes to the court, it's the first time that the court is asked to decide, is this law constitutional or not? Which is the very definition of judicial review. Now, again, most people go to Marbury versus Madison, and there's a reason for that that we'll get to here in a moment. But in this case, Hilton versus the United States, Hilton is saying this is a direct tax. It is unconstitutional. It clearly violates Article 1, Section 2, and Article 1, Section 9, and you can't do that. The court, the lower court, decided in favor of the United States. Said, nope. This is not a direct tax. It is, in fact, essentially, well, it's not a direct tax. So, consequently, no. You're not going to, there's nothing wrong with this. It doesn't need to be apportioned because it's essentially a consumption tax. You own a carriage, therefore you're going to pay the tax. You don't want to pay the tax? Get rid of the carriage. It's really that simple. And you could almost hear the cynicism in that, especially for a guy that owns 100 carriages and isn't doing anything with them. If you were doing something with them, maybe we'd feel a little different, but point is you're not doing anything with them. So I don't see how this is a direct tax. I don't see anything other than it's not a direct tax. It's what the lower courts ruled. This went to the Supreme Court of the United States, where, of course, it was argued by no less than Alexander Hamilton himself on behalf of the government. The day he argued it, he was very sick. He was not feeling well at all. But most people said that he spoke with astonishing ability, is the way it's described, in a very pleasing manner. And he was listened to with the most profound attention. And he argued for 3 hours in favor of this tax, which he, of course, himself had basically written, pushed through Congress, and wanted, even though he was now no longer a part of the government by 1796. Think about that for just a moment, 3 hours. I mean, nowadays they're limited to an hour, 30 minutes a side. But in those days, things were a little bit different. Hamilton argued for this tax for 3 hours. And the thrust of his argument was that Congress had been given the power to levy taxes, and this was not a direct tax. QED, there's nothing here that says we can't do it. So, in my understanding of the Constitution, he would have said, we can. I've just summarized his 3-hour argument in about 30 seconds. The court did not take long to discuss this. It was argued on the 23rd of February, and it was issued, decided on March the 8th. So little over 2 weeks, I guess, or right at 2 weeks, the court made its decision. The Supreme Court of the United States decided that you're right. This is not a direct tax. Therefore, it does not need to be apportioned. The Justice Samuel Chase wrote, as I do not think the tax on carriages is a direct tax, I am for affirming the judgment. Justice Patterson wrote, all taxes on expenses or consumptions are indirect taxes. Tax on a carriage is one of this kind and is therefore not a direct tax. Therefore, the judgment rendered in the Circuit Court of Virginia ought to be affirmed. Justice Iredell wrote, I am clearly of the opinion this is not a direct tax in the sense of the Constitution, and therefore the judgment ought to be affirmed. And Justice Wilson, very simply, I shall now, however, only add that my sentiments in favor of the Constitution and the tax in question have not changed. If you think about those words, though, they are in effect exercising judicial review over the constitutionality of the carriage tax law of 1794. And lest you think that they didn't consider that, Justice Chase added this to his, we kind of quoted a little bit, but he said the term, well, he's talking about the duties, but then he says, as I do not think the tax on carriages is a direct tax, it is unnecessary at this time for me to determine whether this court constitutionally possesses the power to declare an act of Congress void on the ground of its being made contrary to and in violation of the Constitution. But if the court have such power, I am free to declare that I will never exercise it, but in a very clear case, unquote. In other words, Justice Chase is writing, look, we agree with the government. The government's right here, so there's no need for us to exercise what will eventually become known as judicial review, which is probably an incorrect term. It should probably be labeled judicial review is what they should be doing. Judicial overturn is probably what we tend to think of when we use that term now. He says very clearly that it wasn't necessary because this case is very clear that the government is correct. The law is valid. Therefore, we don't need to exercise any element here of our power, if we have it, to declare a law null and void and unconstitutional. This is actually the first time, 1796, on this 1794 law, this is the first time the court will be asked to consider whether or not a law is constitutional or not. Is this law, this carriage tax, in violation of the Constitution's prohibitions against direct taxes without apportionment? Now, why does that matter to us today? Well, a few years later, 1803, Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice John Marshall, his famous ruling, it's up to us to decide what the law is, and they overturn a congressional law as being unconstitutional. And that is the first time that judicial review will result in an overturn of a law. And from there, from that point on, it becomes a standard practice and a standard understanding in our country that the court does have the power to do this. They do have the power to review a law for its constitutional and determine whether or not it is constitutional, and if it is not, to strike it down. And this is what we've lived with basically since 1796. So to say that it's something new is a little, there you go. I mentioned the 2012 ruling on Obamacare. Chief Justice John Roberts cited Hilton as a precedent for determining the power of Congress to tax. Now, obviously, some things have changed in the meantime. Apportionment has gone out the window, but his argument that Congress has the power to levy taxes is derived from the Constitution's arguments for that, and from this case at Hilton, this judicial review, which is in essence what the court was being asked to do with Obamacare, to review the constitutionality of Obamacare. Sorry, the Affordable Care Act, for those of you who don't know what the same things are. And he found, much as they did in Hilton, that Congress had the power to do so. QED, it's constitutional. In other cases, we have seen where they did not. Now we come to the executive orders, the president's executive orders, and what we find here is that the executive orders themselves, I don't really want to get into the rightness and wrongness of the things. They're not, in my view, and this is purely my opinion, they're not well thought through, nor are they well written. But when presented with the opportunity for judicial review at the lower court, the states, particularly specifically Washington State, argued that they had standing to challenge this law. That was the only question really at case here, was whether or not the states could challenge the law and whether the judge could review it. That's the president's position, is that they could not. Well, Washington State said, yes, we can, they explained to the judge, because we have apparently, and I don't, you know, I'm not judging this one way or the other because I don't actually know the numbers, but apparently Washington argued that they have numerous immigrants who work on the staffs of their state universities. And the Trump's travel ban executive order inhibited their ability to function. It hurt their ability to function because it limited their ability to travel. The lower court judge bought this, and it went to the Ninth Circuit Court where the arguments were held, as you know, last week, and the ruling was issued on Thursday, essentially upholding the temporary stay on the order. The court's argument, the Ninth Circuit Court's argument, is basically countering the government's position, which is that it's not reviewable. And much of the discussion isn't whether or not the orders are valid, whether they're constitutional, whether they're unconstitutional, whether they are sensible or unsensible. Most of the argument is about whether or not they can be reviewed judicially by the courts or not. The government's position being that they cannot be. The court's position going all the way back to 1796 saying, well, of course they can be. What are you talking about? They can't be reviewed. There's a lot of stuff in this ruling, and if you've read it, you'll know. Pat, the lawyer, and I had some text exchanged about it. There's some things in it that in the ruling that really bothered me. There's a huge thing in there about the Fifth Amendment that I just I have some real issues with. They changed some of the wordings of things, but we'll get into that on the politics show. But ultimately, the only real question before the Ninth Circuit Court was whether or not we can review this or not. And I would argue to you that the history of this country from 1796 on is that, of course, they can review it. That's what they do. Now, whether you like what they review and whether you agree with their decisions is a completely different argument. But to argue that they can't review it seems a little far-fetched to me. And so that's where the argument sits today as we wait for the White House to either rewrite the orders or for the Supreme Court to say, yes, we'll hear it, no, we won't hear it, yes, we do have time, well, we don't have time. And the real question will be whether or not the Supreme Court says we can review it or not. And I'm betting that they probably will say, of course we can, which would be the first step in the process. What do you think? 565-3283 or dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. This has been Constitution Thursday.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.